serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing today on 96-year-old Frank Macon of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and his new book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, The Making of a Tuskegee Airman. If you check out the cover of the book at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll see the authors listed as Franklin J. Macon with Elizabeth G. Harper. But I think you'll appreciate hearing from Mrs. Harper as well. The wife of an Air Force Academy grad and career officer, Liz has quite a story to tell about the origins of this new book.
Well, I met Frank, I think it was like 2006. We were stationed here, and our good friends, Chris and Cindy, I was having dessert with Cindy, and we ran into Frank and his girlfriend, Amy. It was just a fast introduction, passing by kind of thing. And then Cindy, later, while we were eating, was telling me all these funny stories about Frank, like blowing things up with carbide and dipping girls' ponytails in the inkwell, and that he was a Tuskegee Airman. And that kind of just stuck in my brain. And then we were stationed up in Cheyenne, and a couple of good friends of mine, Deanna and Stephanie, we started doing projects, starting to research, write books, because we had boys and girls, but we realized that our boys didn't have much that they liked to read. They were more outdoorsy, woodsy, liking to do adventures. So we started that, and then we TCS back to Colorado Springs. So bump it up 10 years later, we had dinner with Chris and Cindy. And Chris and Cindy know Frank because of Chris's metal fabrication shop. Frank and Chris have tinkered for years, designed things, probably for almost 3 decades now. And we asked how Frank was doing and was he still speaking to schools and that sort of thing. And Chris said, oh, yeah. And I was at the Griffith Center, which is for troubled and adjudicated kids at the time. And I thought, well, I'll have Frank come speak. And so he did. He went multiple times. And I knew the kids were always mesmerized by him. Even these kids who normally wouldn't sit for 5 minutes would sit and listen to Frank tell these stories for like an hour and a half and not even move. So that always struck me as well. And then at that dinner, Chris said, we have to get Frank in the air again. He's going to be 92. And I thought, well, we live at the Air Force Academy. I should be able to figure that out. So we made some phone calls and they just took it and ran. The Academy gave Frank a birthday flight, and then he spoke to all the freshman history classes. And then they introduced him at Mitchell Hall in front of all 3,000-plus cadets to a standing ovation. And I drove him that day, even though he can drive, or he could drive until this past summer, because I knew he'd be tired. And on the way home, he said, all those reporters, everybody, whenever we do an event, they want me to write a book. And I said, well, why don't you, Frank? And he says, well, I'm dyslexic. And I just said, well, you want some help? And we started the next week, and here we are 4 years later with a book in hand and a great friendship, and just it's gone from there. So that's kind of how the whole thing happened. It was really quite providential.
Sure sounds like it. What would you say was the most incredible thing or maybe an overarching theme that you picked up on from all the time you spent with him putting this book together over the last 4 years?
Well, there's two. Frank has never let anything get in his way. And the other thing, even in the midst of things that were not always easy for him as a kid, like the dyslexia, not knowing his mom and dad, the racial elements of growing up in that time frame, Frank does not have an angry bone in his body. And a lot of times when we go and speak, the kids all want to play. They make the toys that are in his book, and they're all, you know, how did you do this? How did you jump off the chicken coop? And we find that the adults always kind of want to make the discussion about race. And that is not what Frank is about. He so wants to leave a legacy and help kids. And he doesn't care if you're rich, you're poor, you're black or white, purple, green, he would say. It doesn't matter. He wants to help those kids. And he will change the direction of the conversation even, because he is not an angry person. He just, I don't know, he always says, you know, God gave us all a purpose. And that's what he wants to focus on. He wants kids to know, because he could be really upset with the fact that he didn't know who his real mom and dad were. He will change that when somebody asks him, who is your real father, and when did you figure that out? He learned who it was when he was in his early 20s, and he will just say, but that's where I got my mechanical skills from. Everybody says my father was a good mechanic, and so he focuses on the positive. And he said it to me again the other day because we were, I said, what would you say to kids who are struggling, say, with dyslexia or other things? And he said, you can't listen to what other people are telling you. God gave you a purpose. You have to find what you're good at, and you go for that. So that has always struck me, and I think it strikes the adults who are around him as well, because he could choose to be kind of bitter just because of some of his circumstances, but there isn't an angry or a bitter bone in his body.
Who is this book for, and what do you hope people get out of it when they read it?
Well, by trade, I'm a teacher, and Frank wanted to help kids. So when we sat down and purposely, he's had so many interesting facts about history, but the goal was to really reach kids, to get them interested in history. Even kids who wouldn't normally pick up a book, it's written as if Frank's talking to a class, so it's great for a teacher or a grandparent or a parent to read to a child. And our goal was just to help kids find their niche, find a purpose, never to quit. And I know that kind of maybe sounds cliche, but Frank has had so many, you know, interactions with famous people. He's related to Frederick Douglass. His grandpa was a Buffalo soldier. He, you know, so all these things happened around him, and it didn't even faze him. He just knew he wanted to fly, and he was going to fly, and so be it. I mean, he jumped off the chicken coop, like I said, and all kinds of things. So our goal then, we sat down and decided to focus the book to the middle reader, which is like fourth grade through eighth grade. Adults really like it as well. But that was when Frank struggled the most in school. So that's the age group we targeted, because he wants to help kids who struggle with school. I'm just grateful for our friendship. You know, we've spent so much time. I'm just grateful my kids, I get choked up talking about. My son's birthday is the same day as Frank's, and what a blessing. You know, my 14-year-old gets to hang out with a World War II hero, and what do? They make parachutes together and throw them off the stairwell, because that's just who Frank is. He's so fun-loving. He's just a treasure. You know, that to me is more important than whatever comes of all these events and the book. Sorry, I get kind of emotional, but it just really is so amazing to me. I grew up in Michigan. Frank grew up out here. My husband grew up in Georgia. Our kids have this great privilege. I hope that people just realize what a privilege that generation is, and we're short on time. And I hope that they spend some time, if they know somebody of that age group, just sit and visit with them. They're just amazing. You know, it's hard to even put in words, really. But really, by the grace of God, our families cross paths, and it's just been a treasure for all of us.
And now we have this book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, that I'm sure many who are listening right now are going to order and treasure themselves. That was Liz Harper, who wrote the book with Frank, and I promised you more of Frank. I'm sure you get asked this a lot when you go out and speak. The legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen. How do you explain it? What gives you the most pride when it comes to being associated with that legendary group?
Well, I could say that they proved the people really wrong that was against us. And unfortunately, Lindbergh was one of the top people that was against us learning to fly. In later years, I've heard guys come up to me that said, you know, I was flying a B-17. Were you one of those guys? You saved my life. And all like that. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't one of them, but I know some of the guys that were. I'm afraid that would have been very hard to control, because, you know, if I'd have seen an enemy airplane, I would have probably broke formation and went out after them. But most of the guys stayed right, like Davis said, you stick right with those bombers. And the fighters were intermingled with the bombers so that the fighters couldn't get in. They were the first to shoot down that jet that they...
The German ME-262?
Yeah. At meetings, some of them would laugh about how they did it. Yeah, they would tease it, keep it up, because they knew the fuel consumption was right pretty terrible, and they'd keep it up until it ran out of fuel. And, of course, then it was a glider, so they could get it, you know. They quit sending them up after those. When they knew the red tails were there, they just forget it. They didn't bother.
Well, and you mentioned that you go out to the academy and talk to cadets. You've written this book,
to tell your story, and in ways the story of the Tuskegee Airmen as well. In all your associations with other Tuskegee Airmen over the years, what have you drawn from that? What are some of the things that you treasure and hold on to?
Well, the association, and to know that they suffered, or I suffered some of the embarrassments that they did. Some of those guys, when they got off the ship and come back, they had the sign colored on this side and whites on that side, you know. And the officers' club, a lot of them, they couldn't go in there until finally these guys found out that these are the guys who are saving our lives. And then the officers forced them to let them come into the officers' club.
You were already out of the service when this happened, but when you heard that President Truman was integrating the armed forces, that segregation, as far as our military was concerned, was no more, what did that mean to you?
Well, I was ready to go back in, and as I was saying, I was working out at Carson, and this colonel just said, no, you're not, and he got me out of it because I had the papers to go back in. I was in the reserves.
Well, as you said, you spent decades working on airplanes. You know, I don't know how much you can talk about there because you said some of it may still be secret. But one of the things I read about you, that you helped with modifications and improvements on a lot of different airplanes, and that you even became an accident investigator and suggested some changes that may save lives as far as air travel is concerned?
Yeah, that when I got out of Fort Carson, a research company here, and it was made up of ex-cadets from the Air Force Academy. There was an aircraft at a DC-3 that went into the seawall in Boston. They got the, from the FAA, they got the contract to try to determine what caused the accident. And so there was a fellow that I knew that I had been associated with because of his family, and they were involved in the Alexander Aircraft Factory. He told them about me and said that I need to get a hold of them. I got the records from the FAA, and I read them over and got thinking about it. And I said, well, the new pilots learn to fly instruments and learn, and they're told that you trust the instruments and not your feelings. At which old pilots, that instrument panel could be blank, it's funny, you know, and they trusted their senses, you know. So I said that something went wrong with the instrument. I got the autopilot, a model of it, and got it in the lab, and I said, well, this thing's working all right. It can't. And I got to thinking, you start at the accident and work back, and that was what I was taught. So I went back, and I finally figured out that there must have been something in the electrical system that overloaded it and wiped out the autopilot, and they thought they were at the 500-foot descent or whatever they had set for descent speed, and the needle was sitting right on there, and so they just said, well, we're okay. But it was a real heavy fog. And why radar didn't pick it up, I don't know. And of course, that wasn't what I was supposed to look for.
Right.
So I just figured it was somewhere in the electrical system. So they got to checking that, and the alternator regulator went out on them, and that's what happened.
So because of that electrical issue, their computerized or automatic altimeter was giving them a reading that was inaccurate. They thought they had more space.
Yeah. And so then they got busy and corrected that system.
Well, and just so I understand clearly, the situation with the airliner in Boston that crashed, and that crash killed everyone aboard the plane, you, through your detective work, figure out what had gone wrong. The fix prevents that from happening again. So in theory, your determination and your skill in deciphering that saved a lot of lives.
Oh, well, yeah, I've thought about that and said, Well, you did do something.
Yeah. Well, and you've hinted that you did a lot more, but some of it may still be classified. Are there any hints you can give us, some general ideas of the kind of stuff you're working on?
Well, a lot of laser stuff. The way it was set up, I was presented with one problem, and I overcame that. The guy in the next office was given a problem, and all of this, and I don't know, some lab in Mississippi probably got something else, and then this was all taken to some place like Kirtland Air Force Base, and they put all this information. So I don't know what I...
So they had to separate different elements of the project, yeah. So no one would know all of it.
That's why I can't say what it was, because I don't know. But I knew some of it had to do with lasers.
Well, how do you scratch your aviation itch these days?
I started learning to fly gliders, and oh, I love that. And that's real skill. A few months ago, a fella came down from Denver and took me a ride in a T-6. And we were doing barrel rolls and all kinds of maneuvers. It's just like I hadn't been out of that airplane a week. It all came back to me.
And it had been 75 years.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. But the problem was trying to get in and out of that airplane. I wasn't 20 years old.
Uh-huh. You're not on the tumbling team anymore?
No. But really, truly, I've had some problems like everybody else, but I've had more fun in life and had accomplished a lot of things, and I feel pretty happy about it.
Well, maybe that's my last question, and if you have anything to add, feel free. But I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. I hope people read that story in your book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot. But you just said what a great life you've had. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of in life?
Living, I guess. Being able to have the opportunity. You know, when I was coming along, the Negro family, people would say, oh, the white folks won't let us do this, and the white folks won't. And it was the white folks that was pushing me to do these things. So I didn't listen to them. They just didn't want to do it, that's all. They just rather complain than get it done. I never was. I'll complain about something, but it's, you know, it, but I always find a way that I can get around that situation. I can say I've had a lot of help, and that was, I think, my curiosity is what people were interested in to help me, and I help myself. I don't stand around, well, I can't do this and I can't do that. No. By the time they can't do it, I've got it done. You know, that's just the way I am. And I depend on me to get her done. People say, well, you're 96. Well, you want to be doing that. Oh, get out of my way. I can get to, you know. By the time you try to do something for me, I've got it done.
Well, then maybe you're the guy to ask this question, because I'm just thinking, I hear your perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but even though you are aware of the segregated military, you didn't think that was right. Your lens wasn't always focused on racial issues. That wasn't your priority or focus.
I don't have time to be focusing on that and complaining and all like that. Yeah. You know, but I just get into it.
So I'm just curious, because in today's world, even though our military's integrated and the civil rights movement has happened, there's still, in the news, you hear about racial tensions and you hear the verbal volleys being fired back and forth. What advice do you have for all of us in navigating that? What do you think could help us get it right?
Shut up and get something done. And quit complaining and quit looking at that, because I don't look at a white person. I do not look at a, quote, black person. And those terminologies, I have never seen a white person in my life, and I've never seen a black one. You take a piece of paper, white, and put your hand on it, you're not white. I take that same black piece of paper and put it on it. And this color and dividing people up by color or something like that is stupid, just absolutely stupid.
You know what I didn't ask you, because I mean, all your time in the air, did you ever have some scares, some close calls, some moments where you weren't sure if that landing was going to go quite right?
Flying is many moments of boredom, all shared by a few split seconds of sheer terror. I was in a real serious helicopter crash at Carson. What had happened was this young pilot was wanting to become a maintenance officer. They asked me to go out with him and explain to him the things that he should look for if a pilot comes in and complains. And then they could go and tell the mechanic the problem. And the mechanic would know personally where to go take care of it, you know. We had some engine problems. I, in a way, blame myself for this because this engine wasn't running right. And first place, I'd have to back up a little bit. First place, there was a lot of problems was happening around there because guys didn't want to go overseas and they'd do a little something, you know, and messing with the things that it happened to be that this I felt that it was because I had just lifted this that morning, the very air, and it was run the engine up, and it was fine. And I think somebody messed with it. We took off and flew around, and he put the engine in idle to come into the land, and it quit. The engine, I said, well, you got rotor speed. Just keep your rotor speed up. We'll be all right. And because, you know, when you get close to the ground, you call what they call the collective, and it changes the pitch of the blades, and you get a cushion, and you just sit down. And it's no problem. And he said, you think we should go around again? And that little small voice in my head said no. But I said, yeah, let's give it another go. This time the engine caught, and then it quit again, and he panicked, and he pulled the collective in too high and killed all the energy in the blades. And we hit like a ton of rock, and it rolled up. And it was a type of helicopter that you see on MASH. It rolled over, hit a mud puddle. It had been raining, and it hit a mud puddle and flipped over and landed on the side I was on, of course. But there was a hole where some of the instruments went through the bubble, and it was happened to be in the summertime. We didn't have the doors on there. That's another thing. Lucky, and we jumped out and come out there. But I got bruised up, but I didn't break anything. I got bruised up pretty bad. In fact, I've got an ankle that lets me know that it's still around. But anyway, I had plenty of time, civil service time, and so they gave me a medical retirement from that. And that's how I got away from Carson. And while I was recovering, that's when I got that job with the research company.
How do you explain your story? Because I'm just thinking about it. A kid born to a teenage mother, raised by his aunts, struggles to read, looks at the page and the numbers and the letters are all over the place, and it's detective work just to try to figure out what's said there, that he could learn to fly as a teenager, be part of a legendary group of pilots known as the Tuskegee Airmen, do life-saving research on the highest-tech aeronautical machines in the country. That doesn't sound like a story that unfolds every day. How do you explain it?
Well, I'm not what you call a religious person, but saying that, I do believe in a supreme being, and I think that this supreme being said, this is going to be your job, mister, and get her done.
He continues to do that at age 96. Frank Macon of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Check out his book online and join us again next time on Hometown Heroes when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.